It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Hidden Wisconsin. We go behind the scenes with one man who teaches fathers to be better parents.
First, though, Wisconsin had a poor showing nationally today as test results for 4th and 8th graders around the country were released in what's referred to as the nation's report card.
Although there were some gains overall, Wisconsin posted the largest achievement gap between black and white students of any state in the country for both 4th and 8th graders. In math and reading. That's all according to test results from the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
Here with us to talk about the results is Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
So the headline from these new test results is Wisconsin's achievement gap, one of the worst. Can you recap those scores for us?
Yeah, the test scores that came out, and everyone always has to be careful when the NAEP scores are released, because it's even an interesting thing. Google test results NAEP, and you will get such a myriad of interpretations of the scores that it's best to look at NAEP from a broader view. This particular year, with the results, Wisconsin does indeed have among the top five, or maybe we should say bottom five, results when it comes to the achievement gaps between white students and then students of color. So it's not only among African-American students, it's among the whole group. For example, only 9% of African-American students in eighth grade reading were judged proficient. We had 55% of African-American students have their reading skills in eighth grade rated below basic. So that's the largest of any state in the union. And, you know, you can't sugarcoat that result. That is generally not. Wisconsin doesn't generally think of ourselves at the bottom looking up at other states. And there are similar types of issues among fourth grade reading, eighth grade math, and fourth grade math. So it's a significant issue.
So, in adding to that, among eighth graders, black students in Wisconsin scored the lowest on reading in the entire country, as I read it, followed by Mississippi and Alabama. That seems like quite a badge of shame. What does a score like that tell us about education in Wisconsin?
Well, it's important to keep in mind that one of the things that the NAEP is it does a representative sample. So it tells you a lot of information about the state. It doesn't tell you any information about a particular school district. So while there might be some people that are tempted to lay this on the doorstep of MPS in Milwaukee or any other district, it does not provide those pieces of information. So you have to do this pullback and be able to then look at other districts. So first, let's look at this as a statewide issue, not a district issue. However, what it tells you is that these students are not scoring well, A, compared to students across the nation of similar ethnic and racial background, and B, it tells you that a lot of students in Wisconsin that are white and Anglo are doing well. So this is an interesting sort of double-edged sword, two sides of the same coin, et cetera, idea. So it's one of these good news, bad news things, but it's so extreme on the poor performance of non-white students statewide that this is clearly something that has to get the attention of the state, and any one particular district is either, you know, it's incorrect to lay this at any one particular district.
Well, and given that the national conversation lately in education has been focused on closing the achievement gap, even though there have been gains overall among broad categories of students, we have to look at this achievement gap and where Wisconsin's showing up. How does a failure like this read nationally if you're looking at it from that level?
Well, and that is interesting because we do know that there are things that schools can do that address increasing academic achievement for students. For example, we know that there are very effective reading programs, like the Reading Recovery Program. Anybody out there listening that knows anything about reading knows that that's the gold standard for effective reading remediation programs. It's phenomenal. It's very expensive. So districts have tried to use variations of that program. However, one of the things to keep in mind is if you are increasing the academic performance of students that are already doing well will statistically increase their performance even faster, and students that are not doing well will improve, but they will improve at a slower pace. So what that means is that overall improvement increases, it just increases faster for those students positioned socially, economically, culturally, to be able to excel at school, and it increases slower for students that are not as positioned to be able to take advantage of increased school performance. So you can't just say it's one size fits all, and that's the big issue here. It's not one size fits all. So we've been testing like crazy for a decade and a half, maybe two decades. Maybe it's time to rethink how we approach some of these needs. Maybe it's time to have a more distribution of research and innovation and involve classroom teachers in this conversation and not just impose another new program of the day on classes. So, you know, it's a complex issue, but it's a real problem because those students deal with that every single day. And this is across the nation, of course, too, not just in Wisconsin.
Well, what you're talking about, you know, sounds like something that would be a perfect thing to try, individualizing the education plans for each student. But everyone knows that in schools, they're strapped for time, they're strapped for resources, they're strapped for person power. How could something like that actually be implemented?
And I think you raise a really, really valuable point. Education in Wisconsin, at least on the K-12 level, has taken some significant hits in the last 2 years. And this is not an overall area that has extremely high amounts of morale. Last couple of years, you've had the teachers that have been at least partially blamed, I think, misdirectingly, for the deficit in Wisconsin. So you've had the decertification of unions. You've had districts now that are helping to distribute money to voucher schools. And then you have the state agency that's overseeing part of this distribution of money to private schools. So the trend that this might portend, one would look at this and say, boy, where's the motivation and the energy, the funding, and the will to have these students in the public schools be able to get the programs that they need? This is a great big issue because research has shown, whether it's choice or voucher or whatever the schools, that overall the students that take advantage of those generally are already in a position to do well in school. And so Wisconsin has some policy decisions to look at that will address the needs of these underrepresented groups.
So are you saying with vouchers, you're saying maybe we don't have the data points yet to decide whether or not this is something that could help?
Well, I think the overall evidence shows that with voucher schools, well, vouchers, of course, are still very, very new in Wisconsin, and the measures from those schools even have yet to be determined. But vouchers came into place for a political reason, which is fine. That's politics. Hey, welcome to Wisconsin. But there is no evidence to show that voucher schools are the way to be able to go to address the achievement gap. Yet, as a state, we're moving towards increased attention and funding to voucher schools. So the point is that there needs to be a broader policy discussion about how do we get all of these groups raised, or are we going to target the underperforming groups only? And it's very difficult to do everything that you need to have done. And so, and Wisconsin has been paid much more attention lately to teachers and teacher pay and districts and district funding policies, and now the establishment of voucher schools and private schools. And this has not received attention in the last 2 years. I have yet to hear somebody stand up and really rail on this issue. So it hasn't received the attention, and it needs to.
Now, in our last 30 seconds or so, let's say your state superintendent, Tony Evers, your governor, Scott Walker, you see these scores. What are you thinking, and what do you want to do tomorrow?
Well, that's very true. Of course, one of the other sides to this is these underrepresented groups also rarely receive political attention. So it is going to have to take more of a statesman's approach. And, of course, there is no simple answer. And what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to look at what are effective programs. They're going to have to develop the time and the training for the teachers to develop these and encourage innovation and continue to take looks at this, because, you know, we do need to realize that what we've been doing probably isn't serving this population very well, and we need to look at new methods.
All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Glad to be here. Thank you.
That was Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College.
Now we'll check the headlines. Then we'll be back with our Hidden Wisconsin series. Today we look at the job of fatherhood. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's time now for our Hidden Wisconsin segment, where we find out about the jobs people are doing behind the scenes.
Today, we talk to a Milwaukee man who helps other men to be better fathers. Delvin Crawford is with us. He's a fatherhood specialist at Next Door, an early education center in Milwaukee. Delvin, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Well, first, what in your life and your personal experience made you want to help other men to be better fathers?
Well, I think it was a series of personal experiences that happened that led me up to it. However, I don't think that, you know, it was one in particular, but I believe what ultimately led me up to it is when I came home one morning when I was living with my mother while I was still in college, and she found me in the car intoxicated. She took a look at me and said some words that I believe changed my life. She said, "You remind me of just like your daddy," and then she walked away crying. Those words hit me like a ton of bricks to know that I was associated with the pain that she once experienced while married to my dad devastated me. See, I remembered the verbal and physical abuse, how I wouldn't see my dad for 1 or 2 weeks at a time, and every time we would see him, he would either be intoxicated and disorderly. I remember leaving the house like at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning when I was about 10 years old, with bags full of clothes, knocking on relatives' doors, just trying to find a place to sleep that night. So you could imagine the effect that she had on me when she said those words. I mean, I started going to church, I got married, made a vow to sacrifice my life for the benefit of my wife and children, and I lived this way for years. And the thing was that after I did that, my son, he started going to Next Door, you know, attending it, and I wanted to be involved in his development. So I visited his class, I got on the parent policy board, did poetry workshops, participated in a number of events, you know, that they had at the agency. And one day when I actually dropped them off at school, one of the directors actually came to me and said, "Did you apply for the fatherhood specialist position?" Not knowing that it was such a position, I applied for it, got hired, and now I'm here today with the honor of being on the Wisconsin radio show.
All right. Well, tell us about the fathers who come through the door there to check out the fatherhood programs, just like you did. What kind of situations are they facing?
Some of the barriers that they face deals with employment, deals with education. There's a lot of fathers that we work with that may have been incarcerated. You know, they came from situations where they came from dysfunctional families and dysfunctional homes. So there's just a lot of different things as far as what happened in their childhood, you know, dealing with childhood trauma, seeing some of the things that actually goes on within their community and actually has shaped their perceptions, the way that they look at life. And what happens is that they end up growing up, you know, actually being probably in that stage of boyhood, never transitioning fully into manhood. So those are some of the things that we deal with. That's why we provide so many different trainings, so many different classes, to try to get them to see things in a way they probably didn't see it before.
And how does it work when they're working with you, a fatherhood specialist there? Are you up in front of a class or talking to them one-to-one? How does that work?
Well, it happens in various ways. We actually have a class format where we have fathers actually enroll into the classes, and it's like a four-week course, and it's Monday and Wednesday or Tuesday and Thursday, and they come for 25 sessions for 4 weeks, and it's like two-hour intervals. And what they do is that when they come, you know, we have food that's provided, you know, say if they didn't have transportation, maybe we might provide bus tickets. But it's like a classroom setting. But then we have other places where we might have just like man-to-man groups, and it can be topic-driven. And, you know, when they come in, maybe we might have, you know, some food that's available. You know, people can come in and actually talk about some of the things that they may be going through at that present time, and then we can address those things accordingly.
Do you get the sense that the guys you're working with want to be better dads? They just maybe don't know where to start?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, when I talk to the fathers that, you know, that we come in contact with, they always – you know, they have this passion to become a better dad, but they don't know where to start, you know. And a lot of times what happens is that you might place yourself in certain situations and, you know, different things may have happened in your life to put you in certain things that, you know, say, for instance, if you ended up in jail, or say, for instance, if you end up having something happen with your license because of drunk driving, and, you know, different things like that that you learn in boyhood, and you made all of these different choices, and, you know, some of the things that were negative, and what happens is that you realize, you have an epiphany, like, wow, you know, I can't believe that I did that. Well, where do I start? You know, because I haven't been taught the proper way to go, so I'm just trying to find out what is the best way for me to live my life. So they come to our fatherhood class. They are enthusiastic. They want to learn more. And the thing is that we also give them the opportunity to express their views, where their perceptions may have come from. And we never look down on them. We want to, you know, everything that they say is valued because we understand that it came from a certain place and we all can learn from one another.
So it's not a tough love thing, but you try to give helpful advice. What kind of advice, like if somebody comes in and says, I don't know where to start, what do you tell them?
Well, I mean, the first thing that we want to do is that, you know, as soon as the guys come in and they don't know where to start, I say we cannot let our past dictate the outcome of our future, for number one. And one thing that I also try to share is that in boyhood, we learn so many negative messages on how to manipulate and deceive people to get what we want, to be a womanizer, and other messages that we may have learned, you know, on what it means to be a man. But a lot of times what we do is that we talk about the phases of fatherhood, from, you know, boyhood to manhood to husbandhood and to fatherhood. And a lot of instances we skip from boyhood to fatherhood and try to become a father, you know, fathering a child, when we don't really know what it means to be a man. So the analogy that I try to use for our fathers is that the race is not given to the swift nor the strong, but the one that endures to the end. You know, things may have started off rocky for you as a father, but it doesn't have to end that way. So as long as you don't give up, you'll always place yourself in a position to win the fight.
In doing this job, do you see a lot of success stories or people who are making really positive strides?
Oh, yes, I all the time, you know, because we have certain people that may have come in and they felt like they couldn't see that light at the end of the tunnel. And when they come in and they see all the other fathers that are involved in our classes, and they have their short-term goals, they have their long-term goals, and you have to understand, you know, I even came from a place that they may have came from. You know, I didn't have my father in my life for until I was like 16, 17 years old, and he was an alcoholic. It was certain things that he did, but he actually straightened up his act, and he came into my life, and it showed me that it was never too late to be a father. So the thing is that they're able to relate, you know, to our stories, relate to the things that we have been through, and they know that if it can be done for us, it can be done for them as well.
All right. Before we go, just 30 seconds or so, can you share a couple of words of wisdom for any parent out there listening?
For any parent that's listening, you know, one of the things that I would like to, you know, just share is that no matter where you came from, no matter where you've been, no matter, you know, what may have happened in your life, you know, things can definitely turn around if you position yourself to, you know, just place yourself in a position where things can change. You know, no matter, you know, if you had some shortcomings in your life, you know, anything dealing with childhood trauma, anything dealing with, you know, some of the forks in the road that may have happened, you know, I really believe that you can be the pioneer of your situation. Whatever your father may have done or your mother have done, regardless of who you may not have had in your life. You have to know when you know better, then you have an opportunity to do better.
All right.
And then you can go ahead and do whatever it is that you need to do to be not only an individual as far as bettering yourself, but also, you know, be there.
All right, Delvin, thanks a lot. We're out of time. That's Delvin Crawford, fatherhood specialist at Next Door, an early education center in Milwaukee.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, some advice on baking bread. This is Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll take a tour of the White House and find out what it's like to live and work there. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Next hour, we'll take a look at why the FDA is moving to outlaw trans fats.
Now, though, we're delving behind the walls of the nation's most famous residence, the White House.
We're not talking politics, though. For the next half hour, we'll forget the polls and the partisanship and enjoy the history of the people, events, and objects of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, from inauguration bacchanals to Jackie Kennedy's redecorations.
Here with us to talk about that history is Bill Bashong. He's a historian, webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's also a contributor to the new book by National Geographic. It's called Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So what we know today as the White House is not the original executive mansion. When did today's structure come into existence?
Well, the cornerstone was laid in 1792, and John Adams was the first president to occupy the House in 1800. It was not complete at that point in time, as I think is famously known. There were only six rooms that were actually finished for inhabitable. And even the main staircase had not been built at that point. So it really was something of a roughing it for the Adams family when they first moved in.
And it got some future makeovers down the road, including the West Wing. Can you talk about some of the renovations that its residents down the road did?
Sure. Well, the major changes and reconstructions occurred, of course, in after the 1814 fire, which reduced the White House to a blackened shell. It was reconstructed by its original architect, James Hoban, and James Monroe moved back in when it was, not quite complete, but a lot better off than the Adams family were. And then again in 1902, Theodore Roosevelt remodeled the house extensively and basically just swept out all the Victorian decor on the interior and demolished all the old Victorian glass houses that were once situated on the on the west side of the house. Hmm. All of those were gone, and he built a small little office building out there called, the Executive Office Annex at that point, but that little building would grow into and become the West Wing. It would be expanded in 1909 and again in 1934 to approximately the size that it is today.
So it wasn't as bad as the British burning it, but the White House took some hits in, I gather, Andrew Jackson's first inauguration. What happened?
Well, I mean, you know, that's one of those deals where there's a lot of exaggeration there too, because of the political climate of the time. Jackson was a man of the people. He had won in a popular election and came into the White House. And his supporters obviously came to Washington en masse and came to the White House to greet and meet him and to congratulate him on his victory. And things got a little crazy in terms of the crowd and the size of the things that were going on. And people were, you know, very anxious to see him and greet him. And they were standing on the furniture in muddy boots. And glasses were getting broken. And all sorts of things were happening. And basically, the crush of people was such that his staff got him and snuck him out the back door and took him back to the hotel. And then the stewards at the house started taking out large buckets of rum punch out into the south lawn and sort of trying to draw the crowd out so there wouldn't be so many people in the house. So it was a wild event, certainly. but partly its infamy really has comes down through the time as well because of the politics of the whole thing.
Now, was that the wildest party that the White House ever hosted? They've gotten pretty sophisticated over the years. I can't exactly see people dancing on the tables anymore.
No, not in these days and times, of course. It was we were still a pretty frontier nation at that time, and there was and folks who came, enjoyed a good party and kind of like a hoedown, I guess, in some respects. So, enjoyed themselves at the house, and I don't think that has ever changed as a tradition. I think there's been a lot of fun parties anyway, people enjoying themselves with both food and entertainment.
Was there a tension for a lot of years, maybe decades, between the idea of this is the big place in the United States, it needs to rival, the palaces of Europe, versus no, this is a democracy, we don't have crowned heads, so we should have a more populist White House?
I think that's really a cogent point, because over time that really has sort of shifted back and forth in our history. I mean, there have been times where people have complained bitterly about how shabby the White House looked and how much work it needed, and then there have been other times in our history where they said, "Oh my God, it's a palace! They're living like kings. They're, spending tons of money on the place, and it should never be this way." It started really with a famous speech back in the 1840s known as the Gold Spoon Oration that talked about how Martin Van Buren was just living up the high life lavishly, and it had an effect on the election, and Van Buren would have, as you know, lost that election. So it was, it's as I say, this sort of swinging back and forth with criticism or praise has changed really over the whole history of the White House. I think, we've still have that sort of thing going on where even in the era of Mrs. Kennedy and her Kennedy and the Kennedy restoration of the White House, it was felt that some criticized it and felt it was she was just making it too fancy and in fact they would say off color remarks like she used a lot of ivory and white tones in the renovation of the house during the 60s, and so people would snidely say things like, "Oh, she's creating the off White House."
Hmm.
So things like that. I mean, politics is politics, and people are going to criticize one way or the other.
Just to give a sense of, the scope of the White House, a couple of numbers that jumped out at me. The White House can host a sit-down dinner for 140 people. It's bigger than my wedding, but I suppose it's still, maybe not that huge a crowd. But also there are 35 bathrooms in the White House.
Yeah. Remember, if we're talking real estate, it's 55,000 square feet, six floors. So most of those floors, of course, are either public spaces or working maintenance spaces. There are two levels below ground for that purpose. You've got the ground floor, which incorporates both some rooms that are used for public uses like the library and the Vermeer Room and others. And then there are others like rooms there for the curator's office and other things as well that are working rooms down there. Then you go up to the state level. State floor, which is really entirely public space, then the third, and then the second floor, which is the private residence of the first family, and above that, another story that is used by the first family, largely an area for some recreation as well as guest rooms. So you have a lot of spaces there, but when you really boil it down, there's only 16 bedroom guest rooms, and the president and the first family really lives in what is a large apartment rather than the entire house, because let's face it, you're not going to go down in your bathrobe into the east room for, no matter what time of day it is. So in terms of a place to be comfortable and away and private, you really are restricted to the second and third floors.
So one of the things that's really changed over the years is the need for different and better security and modern technology. How has the White House, this old building, adapted to those changes?
Well, security, through the 19th century, except during times of war, the Civil War and the Spanish-American War, was really not what we even consider security today. It was just the grounds were open on a regular basis. People could walk into the residence, go up into the waiting area outside the president's office, and this time before 1902, the president actually worked in the house, you know, on the east end of the second floor. So the family was sharing office space and private space right up there up until 1902. So, you know, World War One comes along, and that begins, we begin to see a tightening of security in and around the house. Of course, let's face it, assassinations had a big impact as well, with particularly McKinley's assassination, which eventually led to the Secret Service being detailed to the president. So these things continue on, and then, of course, World War Two comes along, and that's when we see the beginnings of a perimeter defense really around the house with guard houses and sort of expanding outward to the gate, sort of security checks and the like. And then as time has passed, of course, now we're at a very careful screening before everyone comes in, metal detectors, et cetera, on into the house that way. So that's you know, just a quick overview of that whole history. But you said one other thing, and it slipped my mind.
Oh, the technology. I mean, there's lots of computers and things there now that weren't there in the 1840s, say.
Oh, of course not. Technology is, you know, obviously reflected. Its evolution is illustrated in the history of the house, everything from the beginnings of a flush toilet. Thomas Jefferson had Benjamin Henry Latrobe install two gravity-fed flush water closets in the house as early as 1803. So that was pretty, you know, out there in terms of modern. Running water came into the house in 1833. Hot water and a finally installed fixed bathtub was put into the family quarters in 1853. Gas lighting came in the 1840s. Electric lighting in 1891. Then, of course, as time passed, you begin to have experiments with air conditioning. William Howard Taft famously tried to install ice bins in a system in the West Wing where they'd blow over fans over the ice to create cool air and try to cool off the offices. That never really worked very well. And then, but they eventually did, as air conditioning really came into its own in the 1930s, and the house was air conditioned with window units at that point. And then during the Truman renovation between 1949 and 52, the entire systems of the house were completely modernized, you know, plumbing, electric, heating, ventilation, et cetera, so to a modern standard.
We're talking now with William Bishong, historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's a contributor to the book Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents by National Geographic.
And do you have a question about the White House and how people live and work there? Is there something you always wanted to know but didn't know who to ask? Well, he's here with us now. Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 with your questions about the White House, or email talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with William Bishong, historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's a contributor to the book Inside the White House, Story from the World's Most Famous Residents by National Geographic. And let's go to our phone lines now. We have Ken first from Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
I'm doing okay.
I won't take up too much time because this is fascinating listening to the history. But I got to take a West Wing tour back in about 2006 during the Bush years, and I just wanted to comment on how unbelievably small it is inside the White House. I don't know if it's, or at least the West Wing, due to just the fact that there's so many rooms, so there has to be a lot of walls to, you know, separate the space. But it's just incredibly cramped when you go in there. You know, you think from movies and such that, you know, there's these wide hallways and, you know, there's lots of room to walk around, and it's not that way at all. But, you know, there's you know, little offices stuffed into every nook and cranny, you know, with a little tiny desk and a, you know, laptop that people work on. And it's just wild how incredibly cramped it is. And like the Brady Press Room, I think is the name of it, is just tiny. I mean, the amount of reporters that they must stuff in there, and, you know, I mean, it's there's seating kind of like a movie theater that the reporters sit in, and there's little, you know, plaques with the reporters' names and stuff for, you know, Cokie Roberts and other famous folks. But, I mean, the whole thing is, you know, not much bigger than, you know, a living room or two stuffed together. So that's really my only comment, is that it's really cramped.
Interesting. So what about that, William? He makes it sound like a bit of a rabbit's warren. Does it feel like that?
I think his name was Ken. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
I think, yeah, he's absolutely right. The West Wing has not been really, you know, undergone another major expansion since the time of FDR. And what has happened is that the spaces that were a little more airy, like there used to be a major waiting room in the West Wing during the FDR's time, and all of that area now has been broken up into these smaller offices that Ken described, and there are 450 people approximately working in the West Wing. So that's a lot of folks in a small area. Of course, proximity to power is the issue here, and people, the closer you are to the president, the closer and more prominent your role is in the executive branch usually. So it's a coveted space. It's really kind of funny if you look at the history of the executive offices. In the 1950s, they did a study, GSA, I guess it was, at that time, to look at the need for new offices. And one of the arguments made by a psychologist who was looking into this is that it would actually be bad for the mental health of the workers in the West Wing because of the tight spaces they were in.
All right, we'll go back to the phones now. We've got Margo with us in Waukesha. Margo, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to know about the White House?
Well, this is funny because I watched White House Down with my husband last night, so I feel like the White House just keeps coming up. I am curious to know how much say the First Lady has in her family's diet, if the cooking and serving of meals for the private first family is just completely a service that's performed for them, or if the First Lady gets involved in that at all, if that's changed at all with Michelle Obama and her initiative with healthy eating.
Mm-hmm. I would, you know, the First Lady has a very big role in how the food is prepared, not only for her family, but also for the events that occur at the White House. The executive chef at the White House confers with the First Lady quite often on the meals for the day and what kind of things that she would like to have prepared for that, what kind of menus that they would like to have, that sort of thing. So it's very much hands-on by the First Ladies, and her staff, of course, are also involved in all of this, particularly when a state dinner or something else of a larger scale is involved, and the White House Social Secretary is involved in that process as well, and there's a lot of there's a team of people working on it. But yes, I mean, really, the first families, I think you could say generally, have always had a strong input in what kind of food that was served at the White House, and brought their personal cooks in the 19th century to the house to prepare their favorite family meals. And sometimes they were family retainers who came to the White House. Like, I don't know if you guys have a copy of the book there, but there's a beautiful picture of Dolly Johnson, who was one of the cooks who was brought to the White House in the 19th century. She was from Kentucky. And she was cooked there in the late 19th century, and just a marvelous portrait of her, that photograph. But that's just an example of where, you know, good home cooking was something that the presidents and their families loved, and that they brought their cooks with them over the years, and as well as, of course, accomplished chefs who would come in. Really, that's more of a modern type of arrangement. Really, again, the influence of Mrs. Kennedy was very important, bringing in René Verdun in the 1960s, and since that point on, we've had executive chefs at the White House.
So, William, I've taken it. You've been pretty intimate with the White House. You've probably seen areas of it that nobody else has, at least nobody listening here. And I wonder, when you're in it, does it feel like the history is right there, that it's palpable, that you could sense, you know, Abraham Lincoln walking the halls? I don't know if there are any ghost stories that go along with that, but what does it feel like in terms of history?
Oh, there's a lot of, as you probably know, a lot of ghost stories. Particularly the most famous ghost of the White House is Abraham Lincoln. But beside the notion of that, the question you're asking is a very good one and interesting. It's like, it's clear that when you step in the White House, you feel the aura of the the history, the tradition, and just what the building means as an icon and a symbol to us. It is, for the people who see it for the first time, it is breathtaking in that regard. It's a beautiful, beautiful interior. The portraits of the presidents and first ladies that are hung on the walls, it's almost as though they're speaking to you as you walk through the halls. It just has an impact on you. And if you're ever there at night, I've only had this opportunity once, and it was just magic. The feeling when you go in the Red Room and it's lit by chandelier at night.
Wait, what is the Red Room?
The Red Room is one of the main parlors of the state floor of the White House. And it is, as I just described, it's red, beautiful satin on the walls, furnishings from beautiful decorative arts in terms of the furnishings there of the French Empire style. It is, you know, just exquisite, and it's just one of those kinds of things that just is amazing. I'm in this room, and I'm in this place of history that Abraham Lincoln and his family played cards and enjoyed time together. Things like that. Those sorts of thoughts start washing over you, and it really is remarkable.
Well, we can't let it hang there. Can you tell us a quick Abraham Lincoln ghost story of the White House?
Well, I'll tell you how it started. How's that grab you?
Sure.
Actually, in the 19th century, there was a gentleman who worked at the White House. His name was Jeremiah Smith, and he began working there during the Grant administration, actually, and stayed on for almost 50 years as in service at the White House. He started as a stable hand and then ended up at the end of his career as an old man, and he was basically his only responsibility at that point was to keep the president's office dusted with a feather duster. He had this big feather duster, and he'd always stand with it out on the north side of the house, and so the press called him the Knight of the Feather Duster because of this regal pose that he would strike. Anyway, when it was a slow news day, reporters would get to talking to him, and as he was known as Jerry Smith to most of the reporters who were friendly with him, he began telling them stories about ghosts that he had seen in the house. And of course, one of the ones was that he mentioned was of course Abraham Lincoln. And then he also added some embellishment to that and said he also saw U.S. Grant and William McKinley. And the funny thing about McKinley was apparently he said he heard a buzzing noise whenever McKinley appeared, whatever that meant. I don't know, but there you have it.
Wow.
But anyway, that got translated into many news stories in the papers in the 19th century, starting in the late 1880s and building up into the 20th century. And, of course, that legend and that myth has continued on, and even the presidents and first ladies themselves have pulled pranks related to Lincoln's ghost in and around the Lincoln bedroom.
All right, Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. Great stuff.
Okay, well, thank you.
That's Bill Bashong. He's historian and webmaster of the White House Historical Association. He's a contributor to the book Inside the White House, Stories from the World's Most Famous Residents.
Next is the news, and then we'll be back to talk about a new move by the FDA to outlaw trans fats. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.